Infernomatic Productions.
Hey freaks, it's Jason McMaster. You're listening to Metal Mayhem ROC with John, the Vernomatic, Verno, and Metal Walt.
Are you ready?
Live from the Metal Mayhem Studios in Rochester, New York.
We are gold.
And heard around the world by metalheads just like you. This is Metal Mayhem ROC.
Heavy metal music.
Your weekly dose of metal music, interviews, album reviews, news, and more.
Want to be part of the show?
Send us a message through our website, metalmayhemroc.com. Or hit us up on Facebook and Twitter.
Search Metal Mayhem ROC.
It's getting nice and heavy.
Now, welcome our hosts, John the Vernomatic Verno, and direct from New Jersey, Metal Walt.
Good evening, everybody. Happy New Year's to all. As always, Thursday nights, new content drops. Tonight's episode, Metal Walt and I are bringing you part two of our Jason McMaster interview. In this episode, we go down heavy metal memory lane. Jason tells us about some of his bands, his experiences with other bands, and just general metal talk. It's a fun one. First, though, let's remind you to get up to that Metal Mayhem ROC website. There you'll find show blogs, CD reviews. Mark Zagatti joined the team. He's doing a weekly CD review. Check out some past episodes. Let's see. A couple weeks ago, we had Tim Ripper Owens talking about his new solo CD. We had the Jersey Metal Guys. They have a brand new book out called The History of the Garden State's Heavy Metal Scene. That one's awesome. So get up to the website, join our community, sign up for the newsletter, and get involved. So, Metal Walt, how are you, man? Happy New Year.
Hey, John. Happy New Year. I am doing well. So the other part of the McMaster conversation after the Armored Saint and Accept stuff was, it was just, man, he opened up his camera and he's sitting in front of this desk with dusty cassettes and CDs stacked up and posters and guitar picks. And he was just chilling on a Sunday morning. And boy, did we learn a lot about what he's done for the last 40 years. Stuff I had no idea about and all really, really cool and interesting facts.
Oh, awesome facts. Talks about touring with Lemmy and looking at Lemmy and fucking Speedos and there's a story about he could have possibly changed the trajectory of Pantera. So, you know, filling in and part of Dirty Looks to this day. So it's a fantastic interview. It's like we say, it's a cool as hell walk down heavy metal memory lane. For Metal Walt, I'm the Vernomatic. This is Metal Mayhem ROC.
So, Jason, really a pleasure to be able to speak to you. I mean, you know, John and I have done our homework on you. You got a massive history. I mean, if you were to print out a heavy metal resume, I mean, you paid on a million bands, side projects, one-off things, special guesting, tribute albums. You know, you're a minister, which we want to talk to you about. You got a podcast. So lots and lots of stuff to talk about today. So general question before we get into some of your projects. You know, you're a Texas native. I think you still live there. How'd you get into metal? You know, was it played around the house? What's your origins of Texas and hard rock and metal?
I have three brothers, two older, one younger, and they had record collections that, you know, hey, what you got over there? Kind of a thing, you know, well, what are you listening to? You know, and my younger brother, Randy, would bring home stuff and say, you got to hear this. You know, for the most part, the babysitter turned me on to Elton John when I was very young, probably, God, could have been 5 years old, 6 years old. For some reason, Elton John, like, blew my mind at that age. And I just started collecting Elton John records because I didn't really know anything past that other than the little 45s I had of whatever, Sesame Street and maybe top 40 45s that I got, you know, for birthdays and things like that. When I heard Kiss from the neighborhood kids, I realized they were having all the fun and everything. And, you know, Elton John and Queen and David Bowie and Alice Cooper and things like that were already in my collection. So Kiss was after all that. Now, when you kind of put together Kiss as a gateway to metal kind of a thing, before any of it was called heavy metal at all, that came later, I think, like late 70s, early 80s. I feel like I already kind of knew what that meant, because Queen in the 70s were doing Drop D. When I found Black Sabbath, I realized there's a correlation between Queen and, you know, why is this song heavier than this one? And you hear Black Sabbath and you start connecting dots like that. And the innovators, right? The people who created shock rock and, you know, it's Queen and Elton John and The Sweet and David Bowie and Alice Cooper and Kiss. And they, you know, those guys were having a lot of fun and they were creating these larger than life persona, which lent somehow made the music interesting in a different way, because you could kind of, wow, that guy's weird in the head and it's making the music pop better or something. Anyway, so I relate all this to the heavier the song, the music. You know, I got into Rush and Ted Nugent and UFO and Thin Lizzy and all that, and saw a bunch of those bands play in the late 70s. And I had my first band as a bass player when I was about 14 or 15. I moved to Austin, Texas. I'm from Gulf of Mexico, Corpus Christi, Texas. And I moved to Austin, Texas, when I was about 16 or 17, and just continued my bass playing and started singing a little bit. I think I started singing when I was like 17, and then I joined Watchtower in May of 1982 as just a front man, which I'd never done that before. So I cut my teeth as a front man in Watchtower. But I'm getting ahead of you guys. The thing that really was the gateway was probably Kiss, as to where I was going with heavy metal thunder, as it were. You know, the things that I loved about music seemed to be shock, you know, and volume and speed and agility, and I was always finding something new about it. But you know, I still love AC/DC.
Of course.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like yeah. as basic as big dumb, you know, 3-minute songs with one bass note all the way through. I'm down with that just as much as I am, you know, the fastest, craziest Rush song or Dream Theater or Watchtower or whatever. But I also love Venom and Merciful Fate just as much as I did in 1981, 82.
We all grew up on the same stuff. What was your first concert, and did you ever have a chance to see any of those Texas Jam Stadium shows? They had early Van Halen, Sabbath, all that.
No, my younger brother saw, I think he either saw the Van Halen Black Sabbath, Never Say Die tour, Ozzy's last tour. I think he saw that. And those Texas Jam things were happening when I wasn't driving yet.
Yeah, those were in the Cotton Bowl in Dallas.
Yeah, Dallas. Yeah. That's like, that was like 4 or 5 hours away from my 16-year-old ass. So too much, 17, you know, there were, I'm not making excuses, but no, I didn't see any of those. My first concert was in 1977 in Corpus Christi. That year I saw, my first concert was UFO supporting Rush. Mind-blowing. I think I cried. I was just like, what is happening to myself? My young, impressionable mind is warped forever now. This is, how are they creating this sorcery? And I was probably 13, and because that's 12 or 13, 77, yeah.
Farewell to Kings tour?
Yes. UFO obsession, yeah.
Probably like $4 too.
Unbelievable. Yeah, unbelievable. Max Webster might have opened the show, but I got there late, apparently, because I don't remember Max Webster. Oddly enough, I ended up, you know, covering songs by pretty much everyone I ever saw when I was a child. So But I saw Angel open for Ted Nugent the same year. I saw Axe. I saw Nugent when he was good, you know, a couple times in the 70s. And then in the shows in the 80s were all about, you know, Scorpions and Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. And,
yep.
And all of the opening bands were like Dio and Fastway and Girl School and Y&T and Riot and Quiet Riot and Whitesnake and yeah.
I know. I was there, man. Yeah. I'm like 2 years younger than you, but maybe 2 or 3 years older than Walt. So between us, he's jealous of some of the shows I've seen because of age. And here I am turning around and jealous because you had a chance to see Farewell the Kings when I didn't. It's a whole other discussion. But I have a history in radio, and I got into this before. And so we also have a live radio show on Metal Devastation Radio. And we also have dipped our toe in club level promoting. So back in October, we promoted the Raven Stop up here in Rochester. And that's how we got the connection with you and Alan Ticchio. So, well, tell Jason the whole story behind that.
It's such a small community, but we start up there, right? So I live in Jersey. Verno's putting on the show in Rochester, but the Raven Riot Act show is coming down to Jersey at Dingbats a few weeks later. We go ahead and we interview Rick Ventura prior to the tour. I say, Rick, it's a shame. I can't meet you. There's no show. My phone beeps later. Oh, there's a show at Dingbats that was added at the end. Great. I go down there. I'm sitting in the lobby. I'm shooting the shit with Rick. Rick turns around. Who's this guy that walks in but Alan Ticchio? And then, hey, who are you? Oh, I'm Lance and this and that. And the other. Hey, great, man. Hey, I got this book out. Oh, yeah, I heard about it. Next thing you know, he's introducing me to Frank White. Hey, you want to get on our show? So fast forward, then, you know, Alan and I are keeping in touch. And we interviewed him about a week and a half ago for his book, him and Frank. It was an amazing interview. We're going to have that one up on our forum soon. You know, Alan lives 15 minutes from me in Jersey. And he says, Lance, if I can help you out with anything, let me know. And I said, listen, open up your heavy metal Rolodex. Give me some names we can get out there. And the first thing he did, I got a text back. Boom, Jason McMaster. How do you want me to introduce him? And I think within 5 minutes, you and I were texting. So that's that amazing interwoven weave of the whole Jersey thing and the Hades connection. And I know I was going to talk to you about this later if we have time about the Cassius King thing, which I think links back to the Hades. But just figured I'd drop that. So jumping into your history, I want to talk about Watchtower because what I learned in reading my facts was that you performed on the initial album, right? It was called Energetic Disassembly.
That's correct.
And then later on, Alan Ticchio was the guy that took over for you. So I think there's that connection, the, hey, how do Jason and Alan know each other kind of thing. But on Watchtower, I was listening to the album last night, and it's, as you label on your website, technical thrash, whatever you want to call it, but it definitely was, for the time it was something unique for its time. And what stands out for me is, A, you're singing, you're really, really high range, cool music, but the bass playing was, man, it was like, who is that? Is that Chris Squire? Is that Geddy Lee? Really, really a combination of stuff, yet it had that sort of new wave of British heavy metal sound. So, and I told Verno he's going to make a promise to you on his Monday night show, his radio show this week. I want him to play a double shot of Watchtower, and I want the songs Asylum and Tyrants of Distress played. So talk about Watchtower quickly.
Earlier when you got initial, like a little bit ago, you guys were saying, how'd you get into this? You know, what was your age and blah, my, you know, origins. And I mentioned moving to Austin, Texas would have been about 1980, I guess, 81 maybe. And, by May of 82, and I did have a little band, and we played covers, and I was a teenager, you know, whatever. We were just playing. We played Rush. We played AC/DC. We played Hendrix. We played Crocus. You know, we got obscure for how early that was. This is, you know, that would have been pre-Headhunter, you know. Because that's when I think Crocus kind of, you know, pre-MTV kind of a thing. And it was fun. It was called Fallen Angel, you know, generic million bands called Fallen Angel. Anyway, I was a bass player who had recently started singing. That funny story is kind of like your friends at school are like, hey, I'm a singer. Oh, cool. Come by and sing. We don't have a singer. Come by, you know. They come in and they sing, and we're playing and listening to them sing, and me and the drummer looking at each other behind their back going, thought they said they were a singer. You and me are not singers, and we're better than this singer. Not, you know, that's, you kind of are, it's your baby, right? It's what you do to kill time and get your jollies out to play, you know, rock star in your mind when you're a teenager. Without really any aspirations of being a rock star or being, you know, this larger than life thing. You're just like, can't believe that, hey, we started a song and finished it together, sort of, and it was fun. You know, that's kind of where we were. Well, me and the drummer ended up singing for this short-lived project. The guitar players in that project, it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't serious. They, you know, ran off to do other things or chase girls or whatever. And we were looking kind of for just a guitar player to keep the thing going for fun. And I found in a music store, I found this hand-drawn card that said Watchtower. And of course it had a castle with a dragon and fire, and, you know, it was hand-drawn, and it said available for parties, you know, kind of a thing. Obviously high school kids. Heavy metal, blah, blah, blah. And it had actual phone numbers of the band members on the fucking thing. Pre-email, right? This is 1981, 82, right? So I either stole the card or I took the, no, I can't remember. I think I took it. And I wish I still had it. And I had heard of these guys. I had not heard them, but I had heard of them, especially guitar player Billy White. Billy White, I could talk an hour about him. I call his house. He's the first number on there. I call the house. Hey, can I talk to Billy? And it's like, who's this? Well, he doesn't know me. My name's Jason. I got his number off the wall, blah, 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 blah. So Billy gets on the phone and I say, you don't know me. I just saw your number. I'm not trying to headhunt anybody. I don't know anybody. I've only been in Austin like 9 months, you know. I had this band Fallen Angel. We're just looking for a guitar player. Do you know anybody who's just kind of can come jam with us? And he's like, I've heard of you. Me, he's talking about me. And he's like, he goes, I heard you're pretty good. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? I'm fucking terrible. Not, you know, to mince anything, but he says, hey, we should hang out. You should come over sometime. And so the next day I take my bass and a little practice amp and I go and I hang out with Billy White, and this is awesome. Ding dong. Dad answers the door and I'm like, hi, I'm Jason. I'm looking for Billy. And Dad moves out of the way, and there's this kid there with hair down to his ass, all one length. And I'm just like, you know, and it's 1982, and I'm going, oh yeah, this is going to, we're kindred.
Yeah.
We go in his room. There's Iron Maiden, Rush posters, UFO all over. And I'm like, whoa. And I'm like, you know, his room looked like my room or your room or their room or her room or everyone's, you know, it was awesome. And I'm just looking around going, whoa, I have that one. I have that one. And then all of a sudden I hear this, I just hear shredding. And I'm like, and I turn around. And I put my bass back in the case. I threw it in the fireplace. That rhymes. So anyway, the rest is kind of history. Like a week later, they asked me to be the singer. They literally exited their singer they currently had. And we started playing shows. And they were playing some of their original material. And I was like, what the fuck is that? Because it wasn't, you know, Crocus.
There's your first exposure to shredding? Well,
it was my first exposure to...
182, yeah.
To some kids in front of me, my age, playing intricate time signatures, tighter than anyone else I had ever been in a room with, trying to play 2112. But they wrote the fucking material, right? So I'm just like, you know, freaking out. What the fuck is this? So, you know, and they had a list of cover songs. It literally invited me over basically to watch. Here's more of a, this is kind of a cool thing here, is before they had called me and said, hey, we want you to be the singer. I was invited to a rehearsal. I met all the guys and, hey, cool. And their singer's not there yet. And ultimately their singer did not show up for the rehearsal. I'm standing there. There's a microphone. There's a list of cover songs. And I know fucking half of them, right? You know, Victim of Changes and The Ripper and Number of the Beast. And, well, no, Number of the Beast wasn't out yet, I don't think. But some Iron Maiden stuff. and Saxon and UFO, right? And they're like, I don't think he's going to show up. You know, an hour later, I don't think he's going to show up. You want to sing some shit? And I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah, hell yeah. Let me jam with these guys, you know. So the first song I ever sang with Watchtower was Motorcycle Man by Saxon. I still love that fucking song.
Oh, played it the other night.
That's so good. Anyway, so I end up in the band and really cutting my teeth as a singer. And, you know, we recorded that first album multiple times because, you know, oh man, we got new equipment. We need to re-record that. The tones are weird. And I'm like, okay, cool. And the songs changed and we dropped some material and combined, you know, it was just a growth period. By 85, we were done with Energetic Disassembly and it came out and it's kind of historical. Now, 86, 87, gaining huge popularity, the whole tape trading thing was real, and the fanzines and the Bay Area scene and the Jersey scene and the Texas scene and just worldwide Germany and the whole, just you know, the network pre-digital age. Phone calls and licking stamps. That was it. So I get letters from, you know, I love your record kind of thing, from Mike Portnoy, Alan Tecchio, Jason Newsted, Flotsam, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people like that. I find out Chuck Schuldiner from Death is a huge fucking fan and all, just this whole network of like, whoa, and I'm writing all these people back. And me and Alan hit it off and we stayed in touch. When I got the offer for the Dangerous Toys thing, Alan was the first guy I thought of. I was like, you need to come to Texas and at least jam with these guys, you know, learn a few songs and come down here. And he couldn't because Hades was going to Europe and doing some festivals and da 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 da. That this would have been 88. Yeah, 88, early 88, spring 88, summer 88. And, yeah, Billy White wasn't in the band anymore. Billy White left in late 86 and ended up on a Dokken record, Up From the Ashes. The weird, cool little story there is in 86, summer of 86, Watchtower opened for King Diamond, Fatal Portrait Tour, and Mickey D was in King Diamond. And whether they met or connected or exchange numbers, I don't know, but here we are a year and a half later or something, and Billy's in LA secretly writing songs with Dokken, and Mickey D's the drummer in Dokken. Kind of weird, cool. Here's that whole spider web, right?
Oh yeah,
pretty weird. So anyway, the Watchtower material, technical thrash metal, the fanzines who were doing reviews, they didn't know where to put it. They didn't know how to describe it. It's definitely over-the-top sort of technical, but fast. And, you know, it's like Rush on speed or Frank Zappa meets Metallica, or these are all things that have been coined in old fanzines. But my favorite is whether I don't know if I made it up or it's something I've been saying forever is all of the instruments falling down the stairs rapidly in time.
That's perfect.
It is perfect.
And I have to sing over that.
You mentioned Mike Portnoy and you mentioned Rush. Tell us quickly about that project you guys did.
Oh, yeah. That was in 2005. Cygnus and the Sea Monsters live at the Vic Theater, Chicago. One rehearsal. He needed someone who could do Getty, and I just did my best Getty because, you know, he was a Watchtower fan and knew that that was a big player in the influence of that style of singing. And that was amazing because, I got to work with some bad motherfuckers. Paul Gilbert and.
Well, which Rush did you do? What was the time?
It's on YouTube. They did YYZ. We did side one of 2112. We also did Cygnus X1, book one, I think. And we did Hemispheres, the whole song, Hemispheres.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible, man.
You have a chance to see that Primus project that was touring this? When was that? Well, last summer?
It was last year, 2021. I saw it a couple times up by me. It was awesome.
I did not see it, but I heard all about it, and I watched some of it on YouTube, and I'm a music teacher, and some of my students went and saw it at the Aztec Theater in San Antonio. And they loved it. They came back wearing T-shirts the next day. I could talk about Rush for an hour.
I always think about, like, they had such a big following. Rush in Dallas was one of the places they filmed one of their DVDs. I know they had a big, big following down there. So, and talking about Texas, I was thinking as you were telling us, Jason, we had Nigel Glockner on end of the summer to talk about his side project.
6x6.
Yeah. And he lives down in Dallas as well. So he's down there too. So. Yeah.
He lived near us for a little while. He was in Austin. He was out on Lake Travis for a few years. His wife is from San Antonio. So,
hey, Jason, I want to be mindful of your time, but I'd like to quickly make sure we cover off on the big point of your career, the Dangerous Toys. You know, you guys put out four albums. You were on Columbia Records. You had Max Norman, Roy Thomas Baker producing. You know, you had MTV Hits. This was like that sweet spot. You were out there, and both Vernon and I were talking before we got on air. We were on the we both saw the Operation Rock and Roll tour. I saw it down in the Meadowlands in East Rutherford.
Yeah.
Talk about that tour. I mean, that was like a massive package. Priest, Cooper, Motorhead, Metal Church, Dangerous Toys. It was the weird time the Gulf War was going on, right?
Yeah. Talk about living the dream, touring with your idols. I mean, Alice Cooper and Judas Priest alone, but Motorhead and Metal Church are going to be there too. It's like, what the fuck is Dangerous Toys doing on this thing? You know, I love it that they called it Operation Rock and Roll and they didn't call it some kind of metal monster, thing. Because, Motorhead is a rock and roll band and Metal Church is a metal band. And Alice Cooper is shock rock, rock and roll, bluesy shock rock. Yeah. And then Priest is a metal band, but they have so much more than that too. So it was basically what people don't like, really. I don't think they like to hear the truth is it was kind of a ditch effort for the record label to sort of clean house because of the musical climate. It was summer of 91. A lot of people say those ticket sales were terrible that summer because of the musical climate, and there was just another genre where had sort of stepped in and became popular, and that's fine. No one can control that. There was a lot of kick-ass rock and roll being made and played and touring and you know, Soundgarden and Nirvana and Pearl Jam and so many great moments in musical history were happening there. So some of it might have been scaled down a little bit, but that's okay. That didn't scare anybody who I have befriended in my career because of the legendary status of all of the headliners on that Operation Rock and Roll tour. And if someone was being a crybaby about, oh, that tour tanked, it's like, why do you care? Are you the bean counter, or do you work in the production office at the ticket agency? Why are you gonna just vent about, you know, ticket sales and how much money's not being spent or being made because of the, you know, what you're, you know, bringing up the fact that maybe, you know, our music is not as popular right now as it is as other places. You know, if you're following the trends, that's fine. If you feel like you need to change your wardrobe, go right ahead. But everyone who came to the party, it's a sea of kids wearing black with you know, headbanging and shouting freedom. So it was a great tour. It was I was just one of those I'm not worthy moments, you know. Like, I have video of Lemmy in our dressing room and he's playing a guitar wearing Daisy Dukes and nothing else, half drunk at, you know, 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and we're dressed up getting ready to go on. Moments I'll never forget. I remember seeing Lemmy wearing red Speedo and flip flops on a lounger in front of his tour bus with Wurzel, drinking Jack and smoking cigarettes in front of their tour bus. And on the marquee, you know, on the front of the tour bus up there, it says "Slow Death." And those guys are just chilling. He's in a red Speedo and nothing else. Cop shades, of course, smoking cigarettes, drinking Jack in the middle of the afternoon. Not a care in the world. Best thing I've ever seen.
Jason, I'm going to share a quick little story. I'm up here in Rochester. You ever been to the House of Guitars in Rochester?
No, but I have a bunch of their shirts. Because I know of the legendary status. And if I have been there, I don't remember it, and I don't know why, because it seems like I should. I know that the procurers, the owners, the family that runs that place is just as important to the scene as, like, John Zazula and,
you know. Three brothers. But fun Lemmy story. It's too. I ride my bicycle about 10 miles to the House of Guitars to pick up the Aerosmith Rock and a Hard Place release.
Nice. You
know? And I didn't know it at the time, but Motorhead was playing in town that night on Another Perfect Day tour. It was the summer of 82 or 83. It escapes me. But there's Lemmy doing an in-store. And so I get in line. I never really knew who these guys were. It's just, you know, the mole scared me. And I walk up to the table. He goes, "What's your name?" And I said, John. He goes, "All right, John, you're going to the show tonight?" I'm like, "Well, I can't because I'm like 12. And so he scribbles his name on, they had the poster for Another Perfect Day. And he goes, "Well, John, look us up when you're of age or get an ID." And I still have it down in the Vernomatics vault. And I became a fan that day. And
wow.
So
I love that. He was such a class act and a gentleman. I got to hang out with Lem a bunch of times and on his bus for hours, just listening to music. And it was almost like I got to give him the Rolling Stone interview. He just me and him for hours. It's just the best. I'll never forget it.
Hey, Jason, I have to ask you, you're one of your current bands, Broken Teeth. I mean, you've had a lot of years with this band, 20 years, what, 7-8 albums.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, while we're on the Motorhead topic, I mean, you know, I sprinkled around, listened to some of the material, a song like Never Dead, where you actually have the line in the song saying, "I believe in Motorhead." Right. And that's like, this is like all we were saying earlier. You talk about your love for AC/DC, simple three chords. Broken Teeth is that band. Short, 3.5-4 minute songs, fast, quick, in and out, you know. Talk about Broken Teeth real quick.
Formed in 99 as kind of a studio project, kind of a lark. Paris Records, a small record label down here in Texas, got us going on that. And it was supposed to just be a studio project, you know, write a record and do it as a favor to pay for some studio time for Paul Idell, who's been in Dangerous Toys since 94, who we kind of, I loosely say, stole from Dirty Looks. And me and the Toys guys are huge Dirty Looks fans. So when we needed a guitar player way back when, it was like, we just called Paul. And now I'm in Dirty Looks too. So it's weird, you know. So we made that record for Paris, and then it kind of took off better than expected. And so we just kept going. And ultimately, Paul left the band in like 2006 or something. And yeah, we just kept going, and we're actually starting to write again. And it's been a while. That COVID shit fucked up, slowed down, kept us busy in other things for whatever reason. And other projects were born because of that lockdown shit. But Teeth sort of, it just kind of slowed. Everybody from Broken Teeth was in between things, keeping them from Broken Teeth, and we're okay with that. But now we're starting to converge and write again, which is great. But yeah, Never Dead, I saw one of the very last performances of Motorhead here in Austin. And they played three songs. I'm trying to not become emotional here. And it was hard to see, because it was obvious there was Lem was struggling, and he stopped in the middle of a song and said, "Sorry, I can't do it. I'll be back in a minute." And he took his bass off. He walked out with a cane, and they put his bass on him when he came out. So crowd was like, "What?" You know, he comes out a few minutes later with the cane again, and says, "You know, I can't do it. I've been feeling terrible, and I've got to get better. But I promise I'll be back." And grown men in tears, strange, but not strange by way of no one asked for a refund. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So tribal, and the chief is, you know, you're concerned about the chief because our leader is, you know what I mean, kind of a thing. Yeah. You're worried about the general, right? Yeah. So I went home and wrote the lyrics for Never Dead, which talks about the legacy. It's never going to happen. Even when he's gone, it's never, it's like Dio. He's just in the other room watching TV, you know? Yeah. It's never going to happen.
Right.
You can't stop rock and roll. Thank you, D. Snyder. But the point, Never Dead. You can't kill rock and roll. Thank you, Ozzy Osbourne. So all of that came to mind when writing the song Never Dead with Broken Teeth. Yeah, and it's just about Lemmy and Motorhead and the legacy that can't die. You can't kill it.
Jason, there's an old story, a legend has it that your approach to possibly play with the Abbott Brothers before Dangerous Toys and being fellow Texans, what's your relationship with the late brothers?
In the Watchtower days, you know, which was roughly a decade, my time with them, we had heard about this band in the Fort Worth, Arlington, Texas, to be exact, called Pantera. And they were kind of this flashy, glammy kind of cover band that did a circuit tour. And then later I heard about this local band in Austin called Onyx that would do the same circuit. you know, like from Texas to Tennessee and circle around and, you know, Oklahoma, you know, just do this thing. And Onyx is Dangerous Toys, but with a different singer. Mm-hmm. So there was, I knew that was popular. I knew people that did it a little bit. And in the meantime, here's this underground metal thing going on. And me and all my friends are creating metal bands and trying to play, trying to write our own songs, you know, stealing from our influences. You know, it's common, right? And we're all kids, teenagers, right? High school or right out of high school, whatever. This is all going on. And it was 86, becoming 87, and Pantera had lost Terry Glaze, their singer, who they had done like 3 records with, I believe, already. And I had friends who played, you know, like early versions of what I would call death metal. There was a band called Rotting Corpse. I had friends in that band who had grown up like, literally known these Abbott brothers since like, you know, 1980, you know, 70s, and, you know, went to school with these, grew up with them, and were in the inner circle. But, you know, they were obviously, Pantera was doing a different thing than the underground stuff. Didn't know they had, but were writing heavier stuff at the time. Wasn't really on my radar at that point. And because I'm in Watchtower, Billy White had just left the band, and we had replaced Billy with Ron Jarzombek, who was a friend of ours who was in San Antonio Slayer, who is formidable guitar player. And there was only one guitar player in our heads that could replace Billy White, and that was Ron Jarzombek. And you may know the last name from his brother, Bobby Jarzombek, who currently plays drums in George Strait, who's played with Halford, Sebastian Bach, currently Fate's Warning, and blah, blah, blah. He's a god on drums. Love the Jarzombek brothers. Anyway, so it's probably early 87, and their father, Mr. Abbott, I'll call him because I can't think of his name right now, but Mr. Abbott, who owned a studio, and that's where Pantera recorded all their records. And, you know, their dad was a writer and a producer of, I think, country music and big in Nashville or something like that. So he calls me out of nowhere and says, "Hey, I'm Mr. Abbott," and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the boys, they need a singer, and we want to extend the offer for you to audition. Just audition, right? I was like, wow, that's awesome. I know of Pantera. I don't know your boys, but, you know, the name is on everyone's mouth everywhere I go. That's awesome. Thank you. No, thank you. A week later, Vinny Abbott calls me. Vinny Paul calls me, and same offer. "Hey, man, da, 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 blah, blah, blah." And are you sure? You know, kind of thing. "We really would like to hear what you can do with this stuff." And, "Dude, wow, it's awesome to talk to you. Thanks." Nope, can't do it. Me thinking that they're this like kind of glammy hard rock Def Leppard thing, you know, because I had heard their records and had no idea that they were doing a heavy thing. Ironically, I leave, you know, a year later, I leave Watchtower and join this glam fag band.
Yeah.
And then Cowboys from Hell comes out, and I'm like, "Whoa, fuck yeah." And I'm like, "That's the shit." You know, I'm glad they got Philip, you know, because the Transpire might not have been the same, you know, the Attack, you know, it wouldn't have been the same. Yeah. So obviously, well, you know, they did Power Metal before, you know, with Philip. The fourth record is Power Metal, and then Cowboys came out. So anyway, funny things. Yeah. So I didn't really know those guys, but I knew of those guys. Mutual respect all the way around was thick.
Hey, Jason, before we wrap up here, I want to make one last remark about your other gig, Dirty Looks. You know, I always say they were AC/DC sounding, or whatever you want to call them, but they were a very underappreciated band that really had a chance to hit it big and never did, and it's a shame. So it's nice to see that you're keeping the legacy of the band going, because I can recall a time, 1988, I was an 18-year-old kid, and Kiss was going over to Europe, and they played a couple club gigs at the Ritz. One of them was they broadcast it on WNEW FM in New York City, and I was able to go to the show, and Dirty Licks opened. Yeah. And I always felt so bad for these guys because you have Kiss geeks in a little club that holds 1,000 people, and nobody gave that band any respect. And I remember the band was just so hurt and pissed off. And I remember that story like it was yesterday. So wow. I hope someday that, you know, there's some gigs out there and to catch you again with that band. That would be awesome.
Yeah, they can. We recorded a live concert in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania last year, and it's available. It's called Cool from the Speedway. It's available everywhere. It's a concert DVD, CD, sort of bonus disc. It's everywhere. Amazon, Target, whatever. You can get it anywhere. If you want to buy it straight from the band, you go to dirtylooksmusic.com.
Or the House of Guitars.
Yeah, they got it too. Yep, yep. And I think Gene Barnett put those in there. It's a great record. It was fun record, 17 songs. I'm such a huge fan of the band. It's an honor to be standing there in Henrik Ostergaard's shoes as best as I can. Yep. And he was very underrated, creator of good, solid, punchy rock and roll. And he has his own legacy. And I'm just a conduit, you know. And it's a blast. There is talk of writing new material. We've got a few things going that, you know, it's kind of weird when you stand back and go, wow, new Dirty Looks. But, you know, hey. There's three of the original lineup from Cool from the Wire and Turn of the Screw standing right next to me. So it makes it kind of fucking legit.
You guys get out on the road at all?
We're doing the cruise. Dirty Looks is on the crew of the Monsters of Rock cruise next year. And we're really looking forward to that shit because, you know, Junkyard and Rose Tattoo and I think Saxon and Loudness and Rhino Bucket and, you know, all these badass bands are on the cruise next year. And so I think we're going to fit right in. And it's kind of there's a lot of people from, you know, international come and do those cruises because it's because of the ilk of artists that are on the ship. And so I think Dirty Looks is also going to be kind of a prime mover on that. I would think, just in theory, because, you know, Dirty Looks, what? Dirty Looks? Really? I have Cool from the Wire in my car. You know, it's like that kind of like, wow, I got to see this, you know, train wreck or not, you know? So, and then you know, you brought up, I got a zinger for you. You brought up Cassius King. Mm-hmm. And that's something that kind of happened during the lockdown as well. Right around the time my podcast was birthing, Cassius King was birthing. And that's members of Hades for days. So, you know, to bring up Alan Tecchio again, Alan replaced me in Watchtower and I replaced him in Hades. Kind of this weird sort of thing again.
The web.
Same coin. Weird, very weird. It's not the same thing, and it's 40 years later or some shit, but at the same time it's very interesting to me that the connections are there. And anyway, two records in, the new Cassius King record is called Dread the Dawn. There's some videos out. The first video is called Abandoned Paradise. It's on Nomad Eel Records. They can get it on, I think, Bandcamp, Nomad Eel Bandcamp. You can pre-order vinyl versions of the first record, which is called Field Trip, as well as you can get both records digitally anywhere and on CD anywhere. Dread the Dawn, the new record, has only been out for a few weeks, a month maybe, and it's out in Europe as well on MDD Records, on the Nomad Eel, which is the American version, if you will. There are, we covered Come On and Love Me by Kiss, and we did Wouldn't You Like to Know Me from the Paul Stanley.
Nice.
Solo record. And there's a video for Wouldn't You Like to Know Me out on YouTube now. There's also some videos from the first record as well. Cleopatra's Needle. There might be another one that's not coming to mind right now. And Abandoned Paradise is the new video from Dread the Dawn. The European version of Dread the Dawn has a bonus track as well, and it's Troubleshooter by Judas Priest.
Yeah, this the sound of that band is amazing, and I told Vern again before we went on the air, I think he needs to play this stuff out on his show as well. Abandoned Paradise, I mean, heavy, hard, that's got that Sabbath vintage sound, the doomy but fast and quick stoner rock, just awesome. Totally my style of music, and I think you got to play it on your radio show. So, Jason, listen, we could be out here for hours talking to you, and I do think that you're going to be a returning guest to our podcast, just as fans sitting around a campfire talking shit about metal.
Yeah. But
one last thing before we let you go, this maybe is the kinship between you and I. I'm going to do the little pinky thing, because you mentioned there you're a minister. I as well am a minister through the Universal Church, but I can say I've done it, if I can be honest, not necessarily through a religious point of view, but to make a few extra bucks on the side marrying people. So tell us about your role in the ministry.
Well, I've pretty much retired from the pulpit. People have been asking, you know, once in a while, not in droves, and I've had to gently let them down. I've considered a few clients, if you will, I hate that word, but that heard about me through, you know, people I've tied the knot for in the past, who I love and who were a lot of fun, but I just can't seem to bring myself to do it again, because I feel like my brain is occupied with other things. And I was asked to do it for some friends of mine in the DFW area in, like, God, 2020, you know, just so long ago. No, not 2020, 2000, like 2001, or something, 2001, that's what it was. I did it at the Hard Rock Cafe. I read some quotes from The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, you know, and after a while I just started winging it, and it was so much better to just wing it and just hang out, you know. A bunch of them, most of them, I would, you know, kind of close up a proverb, a proverbial thing I read or found that I wanted to share with the couple and their people, with, can I get a slayer?
I love it.
Can I get a slayer?
Yeah. And so that would give you the ilk of how serious, the whole God and Jesus thing is, you know, with the idea of, I mean, the honor is so huge that when a couple really, you know, wants you to stand up there on the stage, if you will, with them, the stage of life, and be there with them and help them hold hands, you know, that is the, that, not get heavy on you, but that's kind of a big honor. And so I sort of looked at it like that. And I've done some where, you know, grandma was there and it was more proper, and I tried to make the couple happy and they weren't happy. And I said, you got the wrong guy. I warned you, you know, grandma might not like my vernacular, and, you know, sorry kind of a thing. And those train wrecks have been very, very few, but, yeah, and it's been fun. I had some fun. The most memorable one, not to, you know, not take some light away from all of, because I've done it about 15 times, I guess. I married, he's passed on, the singer for Rigor Mortis, Bruce Corbett. I tied the knot with him and his wife Gina. And Philip Anselmo, Pantera, of course, was the best man.
Awesome.
And the wedding theme was played on a Flying V through Marshall Stacks behind me on the stage. by the guitar player for Rigor Mortis, Mike Scoscia, who's also passed on. The groomsmen were basically members of GWAR and Rigor Mortis and Pantera and, oh my God, you know, just crazy DFW metal gods everywhere. So I was like, whoa, this is crazy, you know. So, and then my band, one of my bands, Evil United, was one of the bands that played. So it was like, you may now kiss the bride, and then thrash bands come on. You know, it was fucking incredible.
That's awesome.
So yeah.
You know what's incredible is the name, Pastor McMaster from the Church of Disaster.
I have to give Scott from Dangerous Toys the credit for that. And I, you know, it's not like my name's not fun to rhyme with. I realize that. So.
Well, Jason McMaster, you are a true lifer of heavy metal. Like Walt said, we could go on all morning, but remember, Jason will be at the Rockin' Pod March 17th through the 19th, 2023, down in Nashville. Come on down, shoot the shit, bring your Dangerous Toys, bring your Watchtower merch, have him sign it, buy him a beer if he drinks, don't even know that, but the stories are fabulous, and we appreciate you spending your Sunday morning with us.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yep. Thanks, Jason. It was a lot of fun. Cheers. Awesome.
Cheers.
Metal for Life.
Thank you for listening to Metal Mayhem ROC. Check out our website at metalmayhemroc.com for information on podcasts, archives, links to all our live radio shows, and all sorts of info. Please like, follow, and share with everyone, even your non-metal friends. And always remember to keep it heavy.